call me when he's ready, I think. Okay. Good evening, and welcome to the regularly scheduled meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees. The board did not meet previously in closed session, and we begin this meeting with open session. Do we have consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
You do? Okay. I need approval of the minutes of June 2nd.
I'll second.
I'll move approval of those minutes. June 2nd.
I have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Millar. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously.
What was the special?
And then approval of the special meeting of June 2nd.
I'll move the approval of the special meeting.
A motion by Mr. Questenberry, a second by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes unanimously. The next item is correspondence. At the time of this, the posting of this meeting, no correspondence had been received. Is anyone aware of other correspondence? Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
I asked Dr. Prater if he would mind sharing with the public what he shared with us in our Friday notes regarding a letter to the Board of Supervisors, and he has agreed to do so. If that's okay with everyone else, I would ask him to read that.
Dr. Prater.
Thank you.
Yes, this is a letter I wrote to, composed and sent to the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. And regarding the letter, it's a letter of concern for proposed Phillips 66 oil spur expansion. Honorable Supervisors, as the Superintendent of San Luis Coastal Unified School District, I am charged with the fundamental responsibility for the safety of nearly 7,500 students and nearly 1,000 employees across 20 campuses throughout our district. Of particular concern to me and our Board of Trustees is Phillips 66's recent proposal to receive crude oil by rail at its Santa Maria refinery on the Napomo Mesa from sources east of California. This would result in many additional trains carrying heavy crude oil through our county and near our local schools. The numerous derailments of both freight and passenger trains around the country have heightened our concerns about rail safety, especially as several of our schools are in close proximity to the tracks. There are no easy solutions to meeting Californians' demands for gasoline and other petroleum products. The fact is, oil products are part of the fabric of so many things in our lives, from our cars to our clothes to medicine to heating our buildings and more. But we do know that rail safety in this country can be substantially improved. I urge the Board of Supervisors to formally endorse the safety recommendations formulated and approved by the League of California Cities earlier this year. The League's recommended improvements are not only practical and achievable, they are also long overdue. Sincerely, Eric Prater.
Thank you. Does anyone care to comment on Dr. Prater's letter? Okay, seeing no comment, we'll move on to item 3.02, public comment. I have received no requests from the public to speak. Is there anyone in the public who wishes to address the board during public comment? Seeing no one, then we'll close public comment and move on to item 4.01, business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yes. So it looks like we have a budget in the state of California, governor signed. And so right now we're just kind of waiting to see what the trailer bills, what the information comes out in terms of how these things are going to break out for us in particular. One thing that I'll highlight that I think is a, and again, hopefully it will be concerned when will be confirmed when we go to the school services update on the budget, is that as part of this budget bill that was passed, some of the legislation that was written into the budget allows basic aid school districts to keep their minimum state aid ongoing. So the categorical funds continue. So that was something that was a huge concern for us, because there was a, between the Department of Finance, Department of Education, in terms of whether or not those funds continued after the LCFF is fully funded, was a concern. And so it's something that we've gone ahead until we knew for sure, and we've left it in our seven-year budget. And so it's just a fortunate thing, because it's a little over $3 million a year that will, you know, we'll be able to keep on that seven-year projection and not have to take it off. So it's good news on that front. We're still kind of trying to figure out what the adult education plan is going to be in terms of the funds at the district, you know, the maintenance of effort funds potentially that our district can receive. So we'll see how that all plays out in the trailer language. There's some CTE funds available to us, and so we'll see how that kind of plays out. And so I think those are kind of the two other key areas that are part of the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. Mr. Unger.
Does it look like we'll get any of the professional development money or any of the Common Core implementation money, any of that stuff that it looks like the is going to be a potential, even I'm thinking some of the state aid for special ed preschools?
So, you know, I don't know for sure about special ed preschools. We are going to receive mandated cost funds again, so it's not necessarily just Common Core funds. They recommend you utilize those funds for Common Core expenses, but it's really up to the board to decide how those funds are used. Again, it's kind of the same venue that they're giving one-time money, and then they're basically wiping out past mandated cost backlog that the state owes for all districts. For districts like ours that, you know, did what we were supposed to do to get our paperwork, to have those bills accumulate, and for other districts just to get it no matter what, whether they went through the paperwork and all of that is, you know, seemingly unfair, but that's the way the governor's paying it down. So that's a positive thing for us, I would definitely say, one-time funds. And so the goal would be to kind of pull all this together, bring it to the board in August, and do a kind of a 45-day revise for our budget.
Okay. Anyone else? Okay.
I'll end it on I am very inquisitive, too, just about preschool funds, because there is a lot of money that's out there for preschool funds. You say they're adding sites, so I think that's definitely a dialogue we need to have with the County Office of Education to see if there's some way that we can work together to you know, get more of those for our county and get more preschool spots. And I am excited about, as Mr. Unger alluded to, the professional development funds that are also available for teachers and administrators. So it looks like that'll be on an ADA basis, and we'll receive some of those funds.
Terrific. Okay. Thank you very much. 4.02, educational services update. Mr. Robinette.
Yes, thank you. Well, with the end of the school year, it means the end of SBAC testing. We completed our state testing for the first time with the Smarter Balanced test. We are getting results kind of flowing in. They're kind of trickling in, and they're unofficial results. So they're not for public consumption or are really viewing yet. We expect that individual scores will be coming out in mid-August, and that also around middle of August we'll start getting those group scores, how the schools did, how this district did, comparative districts, counties, etc. By the end of August, which may coincide perhaps with school starting, is when score reports will actually go home to parents. So it's a little later than we anticipated with SBAC, but of course this is the first round. There will be no API scores for the 2014-15 school year. This is the first year of testing, so there will be no APIs. AYP, which is required by the federal government, adequate yearly progress, will still have to be reported, and so some of that just kind of rolls over from previous years. Of interest, though, to us is the CASE exam, the California High School Exit Exam, which is required by law for a student to graduate from high school. They must not only accumulate the number of credits required by the board and pass those classes, they must pass the CASE exam. There is a bill that has passed the Senate. It's currently in conference in the Assembly to do away with the CASI and have it be replaced by parts of the SBAC test. And so since this is sort of floating around, the CASI test has been suspended temporarily. This is a little problematic because we have students who did not receive a diploma on the basis of still needing to pass the CASI, and our adult school provides testing and training and, you know, tutoring, and we usually administer that test in July. There will be no July test to be given, as far as we can tell. So the law still remains that for the class of 2015, they must pass this test, but there is no test to be given at this point. And the Williams settlement actually says that school districts are obligated to train students to pass this test. So we're waiting for direction from the California Department of Education, and we'll see what happens with that. Somebody knows a lot more about this than I do, which is Erin Kunkel. I just want to point out, this is Erin's. Erin's going to do a presentation later, but this is her very last evening with us. I don't think she's even – are you working tomorrow? Is tomorrow your last day? A little bit. So Erin is off to Nebraska to do all this kind of state testing work over there. But so if you have questions about state testing, she's our resident expert for about 12 more hours. On other news, I just wanted to also let the board know that we received word this morning, I believe, that our integrated science course, that is a brand new course, is A through G approved. So we got word from the Excellent. Regents of the UC on the first submission, which is outstanding, good work by our department there, getting that all done. And so we're waiting to hear about the ag science class. That has not come through yet, but we're hopeful. And also, we received yesterday, we got word that we once again received the, and it's become quite competitive, the McKinney-Vento homeless grant. So we will be funded for 3 more years with the McKinney-Vento grant at about $75,000 a year, which is very significant. So good work by Melissa Musgraves and that team getting that done. Questions about testing or any of that?
Mr. Quesenberry.
This is somewhat related to the CASI test. I don't know where people pull these figures out of the air, but someone said that there were 20 students at Morro Bay High School that didn't walk because of the CASI, and that doesn't sound like anything I've ever heard of.
I don't think that sounds like wild exaggeration.
It sounds like yes. Okay, because our graduation rate is up in the high 90s.
Yes.
And
yes.
Our pass rate for the CASI is
yes.
Over time is up in the high 90s.
Oh, yes. But we do have some stragglers, and we have a handful of students that did not pass the CASI, even though there's multiple administrations
yes.
from the 10th grade on. And so they're working with us, and we hope we'll have something that they'll be able to take in order to demonstrate that proficiency so they get a diploma.
Thank you, Mr. Robinette.
If they pass the CASI through the adult school, would they still receive a Morro Bay or San Luis Obispo High School diploma?
Yes. Yes.
Or Pacific Beach, I should say.
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Eisenrath-Rogers.
And just a question about the AYP. And so that's just going to stay the same as last year, basically.
Well, there are other measurements that go into AYP besides testing. So graduation rate is one of them. Mm-hmm. Participation rate in the SBAC is one of them. And we don't think we're going to make the participation rate at San Luis Obispo High School and maybe some of our other schools. We don't know yet. And may not make it in certain subgroups because we have to make participation rate at 95%. So there is a number of parent waivers at the high school level, and so that'll factor into AYP. At the elementary school, attendance factors into AYP. But as far as testing, I don't think, unless I'm wrong, Erin, much will go into the AYP from the testing perspective. Is that correct?
So AYP is just based on SBAC. So previously was CST.
But there is no. Will there be an SBAC AYP rating for this coming year?
There will be AYP reported on percent proficient for SBAC.
Okay. Good.
Thanks.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we'll move on to 4.03 Measure D update.
Yeah, we had a Thank you. We had an outstanding board study session on Friday. Hopefully the board feels the same way in terms of going through the San Luis Obispo High School master plan with the PMSM architects. It's that slow to go fast, right? We finally got the site input, both sites, kind of have the Morro Bay plan now, have the San Luis Obispo High plan. And so Mr. Plaza, myself, Mr. Holcomb, Mr. Prater will be kind of now laying that out in terms of a phasing and modules and timeline, as well as looking at the rest of the Measure D needs across the district, and hopefully bringing the board some information in August to kind of get started. So really get a jump start on specific pieces of the plan at both high schools in particular. We're going to talk about bond management plan tonight, which addresses it a little bit. And so it is an exciting thing to finally kind of see it on paper, what it's going to look like. Mr. Plaza and I both went to the Daybreak Rotary Club today, and we're going to start taking our show on tour, I think, over the next few months to just kind of let everybody know on the coast and Los Osos, Morro Bay, San Luis, and hit clubs, hit groups, and kind of show them where we're at with the process and try to keep that information ongoing. We're also working on our Measure D website. So Stephanie Berteau, we met today actually to kind of outline it, lay it out. And so that's an exciting thing, to bring transparency, get information to the voters about where we're headed and what we're doing. And then I'll end my update on there was a recent court case that involved Davis versus Fresno Unified and in regards to lease-leaseback contracting. So later on in the agenda tonight, you're going to see two agreements that we're asking you to terminate, basically, because of this court decision and what happened. And until we work with legal counsel to get better indications on what you can and can't do in regard of lease-leaseback, we felt it was best at this time to go ahead and terminate those and to move forward in a different direction. So you'll see those later on in the agenda. I'm sure this will be a topic for a future board study session. As we kind of learn more about it and kind of hear from our attorneys and throughout the state. So this is affecting everybody in the state of California in terms of construction, contracting, using lease-leaseback agreements. And so everyone's trying to figure out what the parameters are, what we can, can't do. And so we'll definitely be sharing that with the board at a later date.
Okay.
Okay.
Are there any board questions? Mr. Quesmary.
First, I'm going to be responsible for scheduling speakers at the local Rotary, so I can be assured that at some point I can get you guys out there. And is this going to be something akin to the Blues Brothers, or is it, what can we look forward to? A comedy show.
It's more of a comedy show, yeah. That's good. So
a couple of things
we would love to be there.
We'd love to have you come out. And a couple of questions, just to kind of reiterate some things from Friday's Measure D meeting. The site committees, and we've come up with a list of priorities, and things will be done in modules. And even though something might be a number one priority, we might have to do a number two priority thing because that can be done in a way that's least disruptive to the schools. Is
Absolutely.
That correct?
That would be correct.
And so I kind of expected to hear some from more people about the San Luis High track. But that really wasn't one of the top three priorities to come out of their site group, was it?
No, it was not.
Okay, just wanted to.
It was on the list, just at the bottom.
It's on the list. Yeah, we have a lot of things on the list, mm-hmm. and plan to do them all.
Absolutely.
Well, great. Thank you.
Okay, seeing nothing else, move on to item 5.01, proposed revisions to board policy 4361, new board policy 4161, employee leaves.
Good evening. So this evening we have a board policy that formerly was 4361, and it covered leaves for management, supervisory, and confidential employees. And recently we had new legislation, AB 1522. It was called the Healthy Workplaces, Healthy Families Act, which is now giving sick leave to workers that are not covered under a current collective bargaining agreement or other agreement within the organization. So this primarily affects us in the area of substitutes. So this will give substitutes sick leave. The way that this would work is beginning on July 1st, sick leave is accrued at a rate of 1 hour per every 30 hours worked. And so beginning at the start of their employment, it's limited to 24 hours or 3 days in a given year, and it caps out at 48 hours or 6 days in total. So it will never go beyond that amount. And they substitutes would be entitled to use that sick leave beginning on the 90th calendar day of employment. So once they have reached 90 calendar days, they can use it, and they have to have worked 30 days, not consecutive days, in order to take a sick leave day. And so we have this new legislation. It begins on July 1st, and therefore we had to revise our policy on leave. So we took our current policy and included all other employees that are not included in a collective bargaining agreement. Questions? I see Mr. Unger's smile.
So I just want to make sure I understand this. So we have substitute teachers or substitute employees who fill in for people who are typically ill, right?
Yes.
So we're going to have substitutes for substitutes. Is
that correct?
Correct. Okay.
And the way that we have talked a lot, you know, as a human resources group around the county and really around the state since this came out, I don't know that it was originally intended for schools, but we now have this legislation. And so really the way we've talked about this is a substitute would have to be committed for a job.
Ah.
And then get sick in order to take it. But the law allows employees,
right,
substitutes to take it in 2 hour chunks of time. So we're requesting they would take it in a half a day or a full day, because 2 hours, of course, is going to be hard to fill. More than likely, we won't have a substitute for a substitute.
And
but it is what it is.
The other question for me is when the person accrues, was it 48 hours total?
48 hours total over the course of
Their employment with,
yes,
us. When they get to that 48 hours or when they exceed that 48 hours, will we pay them out? With mm-hmm. our employees, we do have absences mm-hmm. that we pay out for people, I believe, right? Is that not true?
No, we don't have any absences that we pay out. We pay out vacation time.
Okay, but how's that? So is it going to be a use it or lose it kind of a thing for these folks? So if they get the 48 hours, they don't use the 48 hours. They're not given remuneration for that.
They are not,
correct?
And it does not go with them to another district.
Okay.
It would, however, roll into a regular position. Should they be hired into a regular position in the organization, it would roll. So they wouldn't ever lose it if they stayed within San Luis Coastal. But if they left San Luis Coastal to go to another district, even within our county, it would not transfer with them.
Okay.
And it
you.
Doesn't go into retirement the way a traditional sick leave would.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Just a point of clarification. Marilyn, just a point of clarification. So subs are the only employee unit that does not have that's not covered by a collective bargaining agreement that covers this new information. Is that right?
Yes, it could be what we call limited term employees also are considered substitutes. So employees that maybe did a 6 month, classified employees that did a 6 month assignment, say, that came in, that's a form of substitutes. Many people think of them synonymously. So it would cover those folks as well. We don't believe it would cover coaches, because coaches get a stipend and they can be absent and not have their pay be affected. So, and many of them don't work more than 90 days. They could have subsequent seasons, but because of the issue that we're giving them a stipend, we don't believe that they would get the sick leave anyway. So at this point in time, substitutes is the only category that I can think of that we have.
Okay. Thank you.
And I know this isn't under an action item, but if we would choose to go ahead and approve these board proposed revisions this evening, we can do so.
We're asking that you adopt this because it goes into effect on July 1st. So this is the last board meeting before it goes into effect.
Okay.
If you would be willing to do so.
So I'll move approval of new board policy 4161.
I'll second that.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, 5.02, 2014-15 Elementary Assessment Data Review.
Thank you. Tonight, our elementary assessment TOSA and new principal of Teach Elementary, Darla Batistic, will be sharing an update on our end-of-year assessment results for kindergarten through sixth grade students in math, reading, and writing. We'll begin with math, where our assessments over the past few years have been designed to not only measure student achievement, but to help prepare our teachers for that transition to the increased expectations of our new standards. From there, in English Language Arts, our assessments have been solidly in place for two or even more years. Both our reading and writing assessments inform instruction, and most are curriculum embedded. I'm a little bit happy tonight about the progress made by our students in both areas, including our targeted student populations identified in the LCAP. So with that, I'll turn it over to Darla.
Thank you for inviting me here tonight to share our data with you. As Amy said, we're going to start by taking a look at math. As you know, we are implementing a new math curriculum. K-2 teachers and students embarked this year on year one of implementation of our Bridges mathematics curriculum. And this is data from an end-of-year, what they call number corner checkup. And it's an assessment of high-priority standards and critical skills that kindergarten, first, and second grade students would need to master by the end of the year. And you can see overall in our district, we had a high rate of proficiency at the end of this year. And I think that's interesting to say, too, because it was our first year of implementation. And when we look at data like this, we think you don't have like control over everything that could have affected this data. But we think about the things that happened in our instructional program over the past few years that might have led to results like this. And I know one thing that we can point to is that our K-2 teachers spent quite a bit of time in professional development learning instructional strategies prior to this implementation. And we think that by learning those and changing those instructional strategies before the curriculum was implemented, it really led to success with that curriculum this year. So that might be why our students did so well in our K-2 group. As Amy said, our math assessments are in flux. This is probably the last time we'll look at that particular assessment for K-2 and this particular assessment for 3-6. As we go into full implementation, we'll have curriculum embedded assessments as our common assessments that teachers can use for to inform instruction and for grading purposes and for collaborative work with their grade level partners on student progress. So this is our third through sixth grade SMI assessment. We've been working on it over the last 3 years, and you can kind of see that, like our students in K-2, our proficiency rating is in the 70% range over the past 3 years. We look at that assessment and we know a few things about it. It's an online computer adaptive assessment. So our students over the past 3 years have had an opportunity to try assessment online, which helped prepare them for SBAC testing this year. But what we also know about it is it doesn't quite match what the expectations are with the SBAC assessment, and our teachers don't have a high level of confidence in this assessment. When they look at this assessment and they look at the Common Core and they look at the type of work students need to do to be successful on the SBAC assessments, they are seeing a mismatch and recommended that we drop this assessment moving forward and move more towards a curriculum-embedded assessment to guide instruction and also to use for grading. So next year, for our third through sixth grade group, they will be implementing Bridges-aligned assessments like our K-2 group did this year. And That'll be for our, that will then be for all of our students K-5, where we're implementing Bridges Mathematics. And then our sixth grade students will be in their first year of implementation with CPM, and they will also use curriculum embedded assessments and SVMI tasks, and their assessment will look like our 7th through 12th grade math courses look. So our sixth grade group is aligning themselves with our secondary schools, which is exciting and a new adventure for them. We're going to take a deeper look in English language arts. As Amy Shields mentioned, the assessments in English language arts have been around for quite a while and are part of our regular teaching practice. So let's take a look first at the BAS. I think you're all familiar with our one-on-one reading assessment.
Can I ask a math question?
Absolutely.
So given the change that we'll see from Bridges to CPM between 5th and 6th grade, mm-hmm. do you expect that that we'll see a dip or a rise in scores or pretty much consistent scores even though we'll be changing assessments for the students?
It's yet to be seen, but I can say this, that both of the Bridges and the CPM curriculum are strongly based in problem solving. And so the type of work that our K-5 students are going to be asked to do in Bridges is really getting in there and constructing meaning and solving problems. That's even more so in our 6th through 12th grade math program, or the CPM materials. So I actually think it looks like a good alignment. I do know that there is a huge divide between the 5th grade standards in both areas, ELA and math, and the 6th grade. And there's a big jump between 5th and 6th grade. Some of our combo teachers, 5th and 6th grade combo teachers, have mentioned it this year when they look at the standards for 5th and the standards for 6th and the different curricular areas. There's a big difference. So it's yet to be seen, but the two math programs that we're implementing are well aligned in that way. So I think there's a match in that respect. All right, so moving on to our BAS, our one-on-one reading assessment. This is the data for our K-2 students, and again, it's a three-year comparison of all students. And you'll notice a pretty dramatic increase this year over the last couple of years. This year, when we look at the data a little bit deeper, we see that the increase is actually mostly in kindergarten students. So when you look at that 79%, I think it is, in our 14-15 data of exceeded or met benchmark compared to last year's green area, that's an easy way to compare it, we look a little deeper at that, and we're noticing that our kindergarten students actually demonstrated much more proficiency than they had in the past. I want to say last year they were 66% proficient, and this year they were 72% proficient. So that's also quite a big jump. And when we look at that information, we think, what kind of instructional practices have changed in our kindergarten program that might have led to such an increase? And so we know that we've lengthened the kindergarten day, so maybe that's more time to develop those reading skills, early reading skills. We also know that we increase the expectation for kindergarten students, and both in writing and in reading. And our kindergarten teachers had some comments about that. I think some of them thought, I don't know that kindergarten students can do this. But the results at the end of the year, a couple of them shared with me, they were amazed at how many students were able to meet the more rigorous expectations in kindergarten. We also know that we have TK and pre-K students that are now moving into kindergarten, and maybe those programs are having a positive effect with students coming into kindergarten with stronger early literacy skills. And then we also know that the implementation of our writing curriculum probably affected our reading scores, because we know that reading and writing go hand in hand, and as students develop skills in one area, they also develop them in another area. So we look at those, a few of those things that have been some big changes to our kindergarten program that may have led to that increase in proficiency this year. We're going to take a deeper look now at our English language arts data. This is also the BAS, this slide. It's also K-2, and it's a look at our district overall proficiency fall to spring, so it's within 1 year. And then below that, you have some information about specific populations that we've noted in our LCAP. So if you notice, our district overall proficiency was at 79%. By spring, starting at 24 in the fall. If we look at our socioeconomically disadvantaged students in the fall, we started out with 14% proficient and ended with 66. That's quite a big jump. And then if we look at our English learner data, we started with 11% proficient and jumped to 58%. So you can see that even with our end-of-year data, we still have an achievement gap. Our specific populations are not performing like all students. We could further look at that achievement gap by specifically looking at English learner data versus non-English learner data, if we're wondering where it is. But we can see that it's still there. But one of the things I was thinking about when I was looking at this data, I was thinking about our district data at 24% growing to 79%. And so that kind of looked to me like about three times as many students were proficient by the end of the year. So then I looked at our SED and EL data and asked myself, are three times the number of students proficient in those other groups? And if you look at that, actually it's more than three times in both instances. So that means that there is some sort of special emphasis happening with our specific populations to increase their proficiency, and that's I would say most likely a lot of our early literacy intervention programs that we have in place that would lead to that, to those results. So moving on, looking at our common assessment. Did you have a question?
Oh, I did. On the previous
this one?
Slide.
This one.
Was this K-2 that we were looking at here?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it was.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a quick question, too, please, Ellen. Carol, is what you're saying about the three times as many in each group, are you suggesting then that because it's a smaller sample, it doesn't have the same effect on the grid that you're showing here?
It doesn't. Do you mean the whole district group?
Well, this when you were I think you were pulling out like the English language learners, mm-hmm. and socioeconomic, right? So it's a smaller group. So you're saying it's not. It doesn't represent as much of a bump? Is that the idea?
It actually represents more of a bump, I think, than if you look at our district overall.
So they're more growth. Mm-hmm. But okay, that's great. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is misrepresentative in a way that we've looked at it. When we look at it as a, it looks like a small percentage here, but it's actually a greater percentage because it's the number of people in the sample are smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, that because there are different sizes of our samples when we look at the different groups, that's one of the reasons that we use percentage. So that we're looking at, of the whole group, whatever that whole is, if it's smaller or larger, what percent of that group is making forward progress. So what I was saying was that when we started with English learners at 11% in the fall, and we see that our whole district, about three times as many students have become proficient. I was thinking that, well, did three times our English learners become proficient? And actually it was more than three times. So that tells me they're growing, that group of proficiency is growing intensely, a little more intensely than our overall group. Does that make sense?
It does. There's another question I have for you related to that, but I'm going to save that for later when we're talking about a different view of this. But
okay.
That's good. Thank you.
We're going to look at this similar data for our other assessments as well, so you can maybe see how it plays out. It's pretty dramatic with the BAS, and I think that's because the students in K-2 come in and have, like, big leaps to make in order to demonstrate proficiency. think you're going to see it more dramatically.
So, Darla, what I took from your comparison of the subgroups to the overall students and the percentages that became proficient or exceeded was that there is something within the teaching program that is benefiting subgroups to perhaps more, a larger extent than the overall student population.
I would say that's true for struggling learners.
Okay.
In any of these groups, definitely, because we have some pretty intense intervention programs in our K-2 classrooms. Both reading recovery, as you know, at first grade, and LLI at K-1 and 2. And there are programs that specifically target students who, at the beginning, are not showing proficiency.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Let's move to the SRI, our Common Assessment for 3rd through 6th grade students. Again, you've heard a lot about this assessment. It measures a student's Lexile level. And this is a 3-year comparison. When we look at the SRI data, you can see it's fairly flat, not a lot of change over the past 3 years. They're consistent results. And when we think about our program in reading for 3rd through 6th grade, it's been pretty consistent also. We haven't made any major changes in reading over the past 3 years. Teachers are beginning to teach into the Common Core standards, but we haven't greatly altered instructional practices or curriculum in this area, so that those types of results would make sense. We use this assessment as a universal screener. That means just a pretty high-level dipstick to see how students are doing. We know that it's really good at determining a student's Lexile reading level, and that helps us in the classroom teach students. We can find books for them at their level. But we're curious to see if it's also a good indicator of a student's performance or predictive of a student's performance on SBAC. And so what we'll be doing in the fall is taking a look at our results from this spring compared to our SBAC results and seeing, is this the right universal screener for us? And we're interested in investigating maybe some other things that might help us so that we know that it's Common Core aligned and it's telling us what we need to know about our students.
Okay. Ms. Batistic, we have a couple questions. Mr. Quisenberry, then Mr. Buckman.
Mr. Buckman.
Hi. So we've got this prior slide that shows the TK influence and the kindergarten influence, mm-hmm. and so they'll be coming into this quickly.
Yes.
And you're smiling, so I think I have the answer to my question. So this flatness, the expectation is that this will start to change?
That's a possibility. Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm
smiling. Is I think that our district in elementary has done so much work over the past 3 or 4 years at getting ready for changes that we knew were coming. Our teachers have been working incredibly hard to make changes to instructional practices, to implement curriculum, and really modernize everything that they're doing. And I think that we're starting to see the effects of that. Even though the expectations are more rigorous, I think we're seeing our students able to meet those challenges. So that's why I'm smiling, because I think it's an exciting time. Really, wait till we get to writing. I think that's really why I'm smiling. I'm sorry.
Mr. Quisenberry has a question.
Yeah. Could you define for me the terminology Lexile? I'm familiar with comprehension and vocabulary. How does this combine those things, identify with one thing more than the other? So could you explain that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So a Lexile level talks about the text complexity of a piece of a book or mm-hmm. any kind of written material. And it was developed, the system was developed by a group called Metametrics, and they've basically Lexiled everything in the world. And it's on a pre-K to college level spectrum. So companies like Scholastic and others have developed assessments that help estimate what that Lexile or text complexity level would be for a student. And they do it through something similar to a close reading test, which is vocabulary driven, meaning a student has to read a little passage of either informational text or literature that has been lexiled, and then they have a sentence underneath it that they need to fill in a word from a list of vocabulary words. And that sentence is meant to get at the comprehension or understanding, so a student can understand what they read by choosing the correct vocabulary word that would complete that sentence.
So it is kind of vocabulary in context, but in the student has to understand the greater context as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's a different kind of test than really we're used to giving in classrooms, and it's different than our SBAC assessment too, and that's why teachers are wondering, is this going to be the best assessment moving forward? And that will be an answer that we'll investigate next year as we see our results and have a chance to compare them.
Thank you.
Okay, so we took that same data for our 3rd through 6th grade students, and we broke it up into our district overall and then our socioeconomically disadvantaged students, Fall Spring, and our English learners, Fall Spring. And so you can see in this data that all groups, of course, are growing from fall to spring. It's not as dramatic a shift, and I think that's because in the fall, when students demonstrate proficiency on this assessment, it's a wide band of proficiency. So you could be really low proficient and be in the proficiency band. And that doesn't mean you're not growing over the course of the year, but you're still proficient. And it's a pretty wide band. So I think that's why you don't see as much growth in the overall district results as you do the dramatic growth you see in the BAS, where students are gaining a level as they go. For our subgroups, especially our English learners, this is a difficult assessment because, as Mr. Quesenberry noted, it's a vocabulary-based assessment. So we know it's difficult for our English learner population. And so what happens with students that are not scoring proficient on this assessment, our teachers also assess them with the BAS, which gives you that diagnostic deep understanding of where students are. And that helps you specifically teach them, especially if they're reading below grade level, because then you can use guided reading and interventions specifically at whatever grade level they're reading. Okay, let's take a look at our on-demand writing assessment. This is an assessment that occurs 3 times a year, and it's aligned with the different text types that students are learning and working on a unit in. And this is our 2nd year of implementation, so this is a 2-year comparison. And I organized this chart a little bit differently. I organized it by text type. So the first 2 columns you see up there are narrative, and all of our students engage in a narrative unit in the fall. So that's also our fall data. It's narrative and it's our fall data. So last year, when we first implemented this rigorous writing curriculum, we had about 11% of our students able to demonstrate proficiency. And I think last year I shared with you, and maybe even in your board packet that you just received, that our K-2 group more proficient than our 3-6. And our expectation was that as students grow up through the articulated writing program with strong writing instruction every day, every year, that we would see that proficiency grow. And I think this is probably the most exciting data I think I'm sharing with you tonight, because you can see a consistent growth from year to year in all 3 of the text types. In the fall, from last year to this year, it went from 11% to 18% proficient. Information are the next 2 columns, and then opinion argument are the last 2. And these aren't exactly time of year, because half of our students, K-3, does information and then opinion, and our 4th through 6th grade students do opinion argument first and then end with information. But by the end of the year, students have done all three text types. So it approximates what happens across the course of the year. So in information, from last year to this year, we grew from 25% to 36% proficient. These are significant jumps in proficiency. And then in opinion argument, we went from 36% last year to 41%. So I think that's pretty exciting and says something about the effect of that daily writing instruction and the rigorous curriculum. Our teachers have developed a lot of efficacy around writing, both in teaching writing and conferring with students one-on-one, and in understanding how to score. I meet with them to score student writing K-6, and they have gained a lot of efficacy around what they're doing and feeling good about it in year two, getting ready to roll into year three of the implementation of the Lucy Calkins units of study and writing.
Mr. Buckman, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. So the question is, when you look at these improvements and you look at the LCAP, when you set the goals, are we close to meeting the goals that we set last year? Are we ahead? How does that look?
That is a great question. I haven't looked at the LCAP goals yet, but that's probably our next data. I know then a couple of big things are coming up in data. One is to tie this information back to our SPSAs, and I worked with principals on Friday to start collecting their SPSA data so they could measure their goals. And then a next step after that would be to look at our LCAP goals and to collect that information. And then that big step is going to be looking at the SBAC results in August and adding that to our LCAP results. So on the horizon. We took that same data that you're going to be familiar with. Did you have a question first?
I did. Well, I wanted to piggyback on what Mr. Buckman said. I think his question is really an excellent one, and I would like to have the answer to that question at some point. Our LCAP goals, I'm remembering 2%. Mrs. Shields, is that 2% growth sound familiar?
I think it's more like 5%.
5%, okay.
Yeah, I don't want to misquote myself, but our common assessments, you know, while we're in this state of waiting for SBAC, we used our common assessments for LCAP. We reported back with a lot of different data, but our goal was always to improve in all of our common assessments. We could provide that for you in a separate report if that would be helpful.
That would be great. Is it a huge project to disaggregate that?
No.
Okay.
Be happy to.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
So we took this same information and we put it together looking at our specific population. So this is our K-6 on-demand writing assessment information. And our district number at spring at 50% proficient was calculated by a student demonstrating proficiency in any of the text types over the course of the year. So a student might demonstrate proficiency in one but not the other, or in all three. And when we looked at it that way, overall about 50% of our students were able to demonstrate proficiency in one of the three, in at least one of the three text types. And that was a growth from the fall, where 19% were able to demonstrate proficiency. And then again, if we look at our SED and EL population, you can see growth in both of those areas. Again, it's pretty dramatic for our specific populations. I kind of looked at that same way, you know, how did 19% grow to 50 for everyone? And are our SED and English learner groups growing in that same way? Are they growing at a faster rate? And I think that the progress they've made this year is significant. And again, I think that has to do with the writing program and writer's workshop that allows teachers to work with small groups of students that need specific remediation and also the one-on-one conferring that happens in Writer's Workshop, where teachers can work one-on-one with students to work on exactly what they need to know next.
Mr. Klosenberg and Dr. Kale.
These on-demand writing assessments, typically there's the student reads perhaps a short passage that pertains to it and then is given a prompt, or I mean, is that typically what it looks like?
No, not typically. Okay. Typically, students are generating, and this is a big emphasis of this program, typically students are self-selecting topics to write about. So in narrative, they write about a small moment, something that actually happened to them. And then in opinion writing, in our younger grades, they have personal opinions about things like it's important to pick books up off the floor. We have to take care of our books. And they write about topics that they've selected. And that in information, now that's usually based on something they know a lot about, so it could be research-based, but usually with the K2, K3 students, it's just something they know a lot about. Like, I have a dog, and I know a lot about dogs. I'm going to tell you about dogs. But in our upper grades, in 4th through 6th grade, it becomes more based on research that they're doing. And the only assessment that looks like the one you've described is 6th grade argument. 6th grade students did read a short story, and then they wrote a theme-based argument based on that reading passage. But the rest of them are all self-selected topics, which is exciting. And just a quick side story, I was scoring at the county writing contest, and it was my first time, but there were some teachers there that had been doing it for quite a while, and one of them stood up at the end when we were debriefing and said, wow, it is such amazing writing when students are selecting their own topics. In years past, I've read 17 whale stories and tried to figure out what was the best second grade whale story. And this year, I can tell there's passion in the writing because students are picking their own topics. So that's it was really exciting for me to hear, because I know that's a huge part of the Lucy Calkins units of study.
Thank you. Is it your expectation then, or our plan, that these more stubborn, I guess I would say, subgroups will continue to see them grow exponentially more, like from the 10% to the 20%? So is that what you're looking at? Is that what's exciting to you?
I think what's really exciting to me, yes, that is exciting to me. I think what's really exciting to me, though, is that the program, both the curriculum and Writer's Workshop, the design of that style of teaching, that structure of teaching, allows for that time where teachers naturally would work with small groups of students, naturally would work one-on-one. It's built into the regular instructional program. And I think that's what will actually make a difference for students who are struggling.
Okay, thanks.
I would just add to that last point that what we know about our English learners is it takes 5 to 7 years to fully learn a language. So the kinds of instruction, teaching, and learning that we're putting in place in the classroom, although very effective, our kids still need that time to access and learn the language. And so, yes, we do want to expedite it, accelerate it up, but the degrees that we're seeing that we're pretty excited about when we see the advancement in our English learners, we still know it's going to take years to get that gap caught up, especially the older the kids get. So my conclusion is that we have a lot to celebrate around the work our elementary teachers have been doing to increase student achievement in reading and writing, especially for these targeted student populations. I'm confident that we'll continue to see this pattern of growth as we continue to grow in our efficacy around this writing program, as well as next year when we learn more about the new ELD standards and both integrated and designated ELD. It's going to be a real focus both at district level and specifically at site level professional development as well. In mathematics, we will have, as Darla mentioned, a fully adopted K-5 math curriculum, so you can expect to see a fully aligned embedded common assessment system for 15-16. I look forward to sharing our progress in math achievement for all students. So at this time, if you have any more questions.
Mr. Unger?
Thank you. This is really, I'm looking at the slide that's Are students meeting year-end of proficiency by specific population? I think it's really interesting about our socioeconomically disadvantaged and our English learners, how close their scores are. And I'm assuming that these are unduplicated students. So they are duplicated students. So a student could be socioeconomically disadvantaged and an English learner?
Absolutely.
Okay. It might be interesting to break that out because they're so close. When I look at socioeconomically disadvantaged students at 38% proficient and our English learners at 36%, that's just a really interesting statistic. And if they are duplicated students, I can understand it. If it's unduplicated, it really says a lot to what we need to do, not only continue to do for our EL students, but for our socioeconomically disadvantaged students. Thank you for sharing this.
And if I could just say, we have significantly more socioeconomically disadvantaged students than we do English learners.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a larger number.
Mr. Buckman?
So that's kind of interesting that you mentioned that, because I'm going back to a book I read a long time ago by Ruby Payne, who basically said even though somebody might not be from another country, if they're socioeconomically disadvantaged, they're basically speaking another language and their words have different meanings. And I'm going to Jim's comment about language and vocabulary. And so it's very interesting to just hear that the socioeconomic outnumbers English learners. It's very interesting.
Okay. Is there anyone from the public who would like to address this topic? All right. Anything else? Thank you so much for a very enlightening presentation. Thank you. Amy, I see you're not moving. So item 5.03, approval of the 2015-16 consolidated application for funding categorical programs.
Thank you. As you're aware, the California Department of Education requires that we submit twice a year a consolidated application for funding in order to receive categorical programs. We apply for three of these different funds, Title I, Title II, and Title III. And just as a quick reminder, Title I funds are to meet the educational needs for low-achieving students enrolled in our highest poverty schools. These would be our Title I schools. Title II is directly for providing professional development for teachers, paraeducators, and administrators to increase academic achievement. And Title III is to provide additional support for our English learners in acquiring English language arts and success towards graduation. So at this time I would entertain any questions and hope that we could approve the consolidated application.
First, I want to see if there's anyone from the public here to speak to this. Seeing none, we'll come back to the board. Mr. Quisenberry.
So is it fair to say that these funds are supplementary funds, that they don't supplant anything, they supplement our efforts in all areas for these this population of students?
Absolutely, and thank you for reminding me of that. These funds, a requirement of these funds that they supplement our general program, not supplant. And in fact, we have to show through documentation that that's exactly what it's doing. Thank you.
Any other questions from the board? Then if we could have a motion to approve the CONAP. Mr. Millar?
I'll move approval. Well, first of all, wasn't this thing a lot longer in the past? I mean, like pages and pages.
I noticed the 30 pages of protected prayer and Rick Robinette's signature were not included. So, yes, you got the condensed version this year.
And I want to thank you.
I'm happy to provide you the 30 pages.
I'll move approval of the 2015-16 consolidated app, and I like it. It's good.
And I'll second that.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor?
No, I'm sorry.
Aye.
Can I just ask a quick question? I vote aye also. So in the 30 pages, one of the things that always stands out for me is that the small dollar amount that goes to parent information, parent education, is that starting to creep up, or how are we doing on that?
No, it's a title. It's part of Title I, and it's a requirement that 1% of the funds go for parent education at the site.
Okay. Kim, did you get the vote? Okay, thank you. All right. Item 5.04, college graduation information.
Good evening. I'm here to tell you about the class of 2015's plans for next year. So, as you received in your packet, the data was split up by school so that you could see what Morro Bay students are going to do, what San Luis Obispo High students are going to do, where Pacific Beach students are going to go. So this data I've aggregated. It's for all of our 575 graduates that graduated this June. 84% are college bound. From our data that we looked at in January, we know that from the National Student Clearinghouse student tracker data, we've started tracking our students as of the class of 2007. About 75 to 80% of students attend college their first year out of high school. So the class of 2015 is set to be our highest class yet at 84%. 53% of those are off to a two-year college. 41% are off to a four-year university. 1% are headed to the military. And about 3% are planning on working for right now. Some of those, I got this data from the registrars at each school. And so some of those students, it was working for now, but planning on going to college later maybe. So we'll be able to track them through the Student Clearinghouse data as time goes on, so we'll see where they end up. Here are the schools that they're headed to. Most students are headed towards Cuesta. That's 50% of our graduating class goes to Cuesta. 62 students are headed to Cal Poly. That's 11% of our graduating class. We also have quite a few headed to some UCs. And on this last slide, I wanted to share with you all of the different places that they're going. So we have 12 Cal States represented and 7 UCs, as well as quite a few pretty prestigious private universities, some out-of-state universities, some out-of-country universities. I think those are our foreign exchange students for the most part. So very exciting data, and we hope to continue on sharing this with you through tracking the Student Clearinghouse data. And we also hope that those percentages of students going to four-year will continue to rise as well because of our work with A through G course offerings and trying to get more courses A through G approved, as well as getting some credit recovery options that are A through G approved. So, any questions?
Thank you. Anyone from the public here to talk about this? Right? Catherine?
Your last comment, does that mean that the Student Clearinghouse data will follow our students who go to a two-year college, wherever that might be, on to four-year? We'll know who is pursuing a four-year degree.
Yes.
Be able to add that back into our data at some point.
Yeah. So the student tracker data allows us to track, it's a plethora of information. So we can go down to Rick Robinette, and where did he go? He went here, here, and here. Or what was his path? But we can also see over time how each class, so the class of 2015, this next year will be year one. We can see how many went to college, how many of those were two-year, four-year, in-state, out-of-state. Gives us a lot of information that we can play with.
Excellent. Thank you.
This is great information. It's very exciting. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. This is the last time I'll be seeing you.
So. Oh, yeah. Good luck. All right, next is 5.05, adoption of the Measure D bond management plan. Mr. Pinkerton and Mr. Holcomb. Let me see. Okay.
Yeah, we actually reviewed the bond management plan at the board study session the other day, and kind of went through each, just a quick kind of brief synopsis of each section for the board. So first of all, again, it's the bond measure was passed. There's specific language in terms of how the bond dollars are supposed to be used. And so we will for sure, as we move through Measure D and our construction process, make sure that we keep that ballot language in the forefront of what we told voters we would be doing. In terms of the methodology, and we've talked about this, it's kind of breaking down the overall construction management program by module, so specific projects at sites at a time, and kind of diving in each one of those modules, you know, maybe three or four projects in each one, ensuring that we keep our budget in line, that we do the best work we can, and then continually watching that throughout the process over the years as we complete projects. Throughout, we'll be working with the board in terms of that plan, keeping you updated on cash flow, where we're at, how the projects are moving forward, to ensure that you're updated and the public is updated at all times. So if you go down to the requirements of the plan, Kim. One of the key things as well is, and we talked about this a little bit at the board study session, is that we want to ensure that the things that we do are they're also, you know, helping our facilities department long-term, sustainable, energy efficiency, anything that we can also do and implement as we construct our schools and modernize them, that they're helping us as we move forward in our overall budget as well. In terms of the plan itself, we really focused and put the two comprehensive high schools as a priority. I think of Measure D funds as we move forward and talk to the public about it. However, there are other schools that definitely had kind of higher priorities, Pacific Beach High School and Bishop's Peak, C.L. Smith, kind of bring them up to the same equity as our other elementary schools in the district. So those are things for us to work on. As we move forward, we want to, you know, definitely use our local labor force, spend the dollars as much as we can here in our area. That said, we want to ensure that bidding is done and that we're getting the best possible prices and utilizing the bond funds as best we can to get the most out of them. And so it definitely, as it says, you know, in the taxpayer's interest, having that open competitive bidding is a mandate. Each project will kind of, throughout the modules, will are we going to do design build? Are we going to do design bid build? Are we going to do lease back? How are we going to implement those projects will be something that every single one will be coming to the board explaining, giving insights about why we're doing it those ways. And then lastly, a little bit, Mr. Holcomb has joined us as our Measure D advisor. So you have Mr. Palazzo, former architect in the area, school architect. You have myself, been a high school principal, been through a bond campaign and modernizing a high school. And so from those kind of outside standpoints, we've been involved in the process. Mr. Holcomb kind of brings a third leg to that stool for us to ensure that, you know, somebody who's kind of been through the construction management in a district doing it. And so definitely tying all three components, we've found his service so far to be very beneficial for us as we're rewriting our architect contracts and beginning to move forward on RFQs and RFPs and kind of just setting the stage for our Measure D construction. And so the last part of the plan kind of talks about Mr. Holcomb's work for the district and how he will help us throughout the process to ensure that we are doing everything, you know, legal, by the book, getting the biggest bang for our buck, and so that we can really stretch these dollars and, again, get, as Mr. Quisenberry said earlier, get all the projects done that we have discussed and talked about and prioritized throughout the time. And so it's exciting. It's very exciting for us. We've gone, you know, it's kind of going slow to go fast. So the site committee work has been great. We have these two great plans now for Moore Bay, Slow High School. And so now it's kind of the next phase is really to get down to business and get these projects underway and do some great things for our kids. And throughout that process, ensure that with the plan that we have transparency, there's checks and balances throughout the system, and, you know, bringing that information out as much as we can with taxpayers, with the board, to ensure that we're doing things the right way.
Okay.
Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak on this topic? All right, we'll come back to the board for questions, discussion. Mr. Millar.
Thank you. I wasn't able to attend the Measure D study session, but when I was reading the materials, I was very pleased with the bond management plan. I felt like the concerns of the board had been listened to by the group, and you all had worked a process and that addressed those concerns. So with that, I would move approval of the bond management plan.
I'll second that.
Okay, Mr. Quessenberry seconds. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Welcome aboard, Mr. Holcomb.
Two more. Hang on.
All right. Yeah, don't go any place yet. You should just get settled in there, I think.
Yes.
Item 5.06, terminate pre-construction services with Mano Construction.
So as I stated with my Measure D update, that there was a court case recently, Davis versus Fresno, which brought into some concerns about pre-construction agreements, lease-leaseback, how they're laid out, the financial model behind them, the leasing components. So there's just a lot of questions about the process that, you know, a lot of school construction is happening throughout the state of California now using the lease-leaseback model. So due to that, we had two agreements that we were currently the board had approved contracts for us to begin, but fortunately we hadn't actually done any work for those two agreements. In talking to both parties for 5.06 as well as 5.07, they were agreed with us in terms of, because of the complexity and the unknowns with the court decision, that they too would like to back out of those agreements and until we learn more and move forward. And so the first one is a pre-construction services agreement for the Morro Bay High School pool, and that is with Mano Construction. And so our goal today is to ask the board to approve the termination of that agreement.
Anyone from the public here to discuss that? And then what will the process be after this is, should the board approve this? What happens?
Well, so basically we're still working with our architects in terms of the design and plan and putting the bid documents together, doing those things. And so we're just not going to have the contractor involved in that process.
Okay. Mrs. Rogers and Mr. Millar?
I was going to move approval. Did you have a question?
Well, I just, I kind of, one of the ways you phrased what we're voting on gave me a moment of pause.
Okay.
Because nobody's backing out of anything. It's a mutual termination of the agreement. Okay.
Yes.
So I just.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad we're proceeding cautiously on this. And I know it's a little premature to gain some idea of whether or not this this case holding thing or having things up in the air is going to impact us being able to move forward on projects in the way we would like to. But I'm glad that we are taking this corrective action and allowing ourselves some time and space in order to study this issue. So
yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, well, absent any further comment, then...
I'll second Marilyn's
motion. Okay. I haven't made my motion.
She said that she was going to...
Did I make it and forget it?
So, yeah.
Okay, so my motion, just in case you're confused, Mrs. Holmes, is to terminate the pre-construction services with Mano Construction.
I think we consent.
For it. By mutual agreement, we're terminating.
We're consenting to the termination.
I don't understand. I can't distinguish.
Does that make us consenting adults? Is that?
I hope so. Okay. I was just going to suggest that language that our vote is to consent to the termination of the agreement.
Okay. So we are consenting to the termination of the agreement, the current agreement with Mano Construction for the Morro Bay Pool. Does that work?
Or just the...
For the pre-construction services agreement.
Yeah, pre-construction.
Pre-construction services agreement. Okay, and we don't need to have the date or anything else. Okay, that's my motion.
Mr. Unger.
I will second that. And again, I just want to reiterate to people, because I know this is very important to the people on the coast, that our intention is to move forward
absolutely
with all due speed, cautious speed, as it were, toward getting shovels in the ground on this project.
Absolutely true.
Thank you.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right, motion carries.
Did you have a confused option?
Item 5.07.
So kind of the same thing. We had entered into a lease-leaseback agreement to do the high school Wi-Fi at both Slo High and Morro Bay High School over the summertime. Due to the court case and ambiguity with that, we would like to mutually consent to canceling our lease-leaseback agreement with Toma Electric.
Anyone from the public to discuss this? Any questions? Mr. Quessenberg.
We're still going to attempt to get this Wi-Fi installed correctly.
Yes, we
over
are
the summer. It would just
yes
has to go through a different
yes
process. Thank
absolutely
you.
And how long will the process take? Do you have any idea? What are the, or Mr. Holcomb can answer that, what are kind of the requirements of how this proceeds from here on?
Oh, there's a
Mark, help him.
Oh, wrong button. Okay. I would say less than 40 days to go through the process.
Okay.
So it won't measurably affect the delivery of the project.
Thank you. All right. Any further discussion? Dr. Prater. Oh, no. Sorry. Further instructions. Do we have a motion? No, not for this one.
I'll move that we consent to the termination of the Toma contract.
I'll second.
Artfully worded.
No. I had to drive all day from San Diego.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you very
thank you
much. Thank you, Mr. Holcomb. All right, we're on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you'd like any of these items pulled before we vote on them. Item 6.01, approval of... Oh, I wonder why, Chris. Item 6.02, acceptance of donations. 6.03, approve furniture and equipment requests. 6.04, approval of purchase orders. 6.05, approval of warrants and payroll. 6.06, approval to submit Morro Bay High School Agricultural Career Technical Education Incentive Grant. 6.07, approval to submit San Luis Obispo High School Agricultural Career Technical Center and Technical Education Incentive Grant. And 6.08, approval of summer field study trip requests. I would like a motion on 6.02 through 6.08.
I'll move approval of item 6.02 to 6.08.
All in favor? Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Mr. Unger.
Thank you. I will be abstaining from item 6.01 since my wife is named in this action.
And we would like to thank your wife for her years of service to our district. Yes.
I'll move approval of item 6.01.
I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstaining?
Yes.
So we have six ayes and one abstention. All right. Anything on the advanced agenda? Reports by board members. We'll see you all July 14th at our board retreat. Thank you very much.
Could I ask one favor of all of you, please?
Yes.
I put a sheet on your places yes regarding the CSBA conference to select your registration items. The system is very different this year, so I need to select all of those items if there's anything other than the standard conference that you wish to attend. And that's fine. Otherwise, if you don't, I'll be emailing you tomorrow to nag you about it.
Yeah.